This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, discussions on writing and the writing life. Today we have with us cartoonist Ellen Forney, who is the author of best-selling graphic memoir, Marbles, Mania, Depression, Michelangelo, and Me, which chronicles her bipolar disorder from diagnosis to stability, and her new book is Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life, which is a self-help book on maintaining stability. She curated a traveling exhibition about comics and health for the National Library of Medicine called Graphic Medicine, Ill-Conceived and Well-Drawn, and as a visual artist, she was selected to create two permanent, large-scale murals for Seattle's Capitol Hill Light Rail Station. She grew up in Philadelphia and lives in Seattle and teaches comics at Cornish College of the Arts. Welcome, Ellen.
So happy to be here with you.
The first thing I want to ask you is if you can describe the genre. You're a cartoonist who writes literature in graphic nonfiction. I'm so eager to hear how you talk about that genre.
I like that you just said graphic nonfiction. One of the things about doing comics that's long form, meaning book length, is that they're almost all called graphic novels, which is confusing because a novel is fiction. Comics is actually a medium and not a genre, so there are a lot of genres within book length comics. So my book, for example, is a graphic memoir. There's also graphic novels and graphic journalism and graphic history, graphic biographies, a book on John Lewis and the civil rights movement called March recently received the National Book Award. So there are lots of different kinds of long-form comics. My book, Marbles, my graphic memoir about my own bipolar disorder from my diagnosis, which was shortly before I turned 30, for the four tumultuous years when I struggled to figure out how to be stable. And that came out in 2012. And I had a lot of hopes for where that might reach. I really wanted to reach other people with bipolar, of course, but then support system, so like family members and friends, and then also doctors and therapists, and in literature and in psychology class. So I really wanted to make its way out widely, but I was really interested in getting into a clinical context. I didn't realize it at the time, but there's this whole field called graphic medicine about comics and health and illness and healthcare. A few months after Marbles came out, a doctor teacher at Penn State Medical College got in touch with me to ask if I would Skype in to his senior seminar on graphic medicine, because they had just read Marbles, and they were going to discuss it. I was just so blown away and excited. So the professor is Michael Green, and he is one of the founders of graphic medicine, which is a surprisingly well-established field, considering most of us didn't know about it before. I was asked to be a keynote speaker in 2014. It's just an amazing field and group of passionate people, of teachers and professors and patients and doctors. And so that's the subject that I did. It's a traveling exhibit for the National Library of Medicine.
You, as an author, were very, very fortunate to tap into this portal to the wide audience that you were hoping to reach with your book. Then I realized what a boon it was to your work for them to then ask you to make a traveling exhibit. And maybe you could tell us what that entails. What is the traveling exhibit?
As you said, it's called Graphic Medicine, Ill-Conceived and Well-Drawn, which was a pun, a name that I didn't think they would go for, but they did.
I'm glad they did.
It's basically explaining what graphic medicine is, because it's a concept that most people, even in comics or healthcare, don't know. It's the intersection of comics and health. So a lot of it's memoir, like mine, about bipolar. There's authors who survived breast cancer and taking care of a family member with Alzheimer's, different experiences. So really getting to know more than just, say, a list of symptoms, or more than just medications and a list of side effects.
That must have a lot to do with the interplay of the language and the graphics, right? That there's something about seeing those cartoons that helps people digest the material?
Absolutely. It's a combination of hearing a personal story or hearing, it really feels very directly from a person. And the pictures really give a certain abstract, emotional, maybe more visceral sense of what the experience is like. For example, we can look at a painting and really get a sense of tension or darkness or joy. And then also another part of the pictures is that it's kind of a universal language. The same way if you think of the icons that we see at any international transportation place, like the airport, like the sign for the restrooms and the sign for the stairs going down, those kinds of symbols, comics are full of those. Word balloon and arrows and panel borders and things like that, that we just understand. And so we're really brought into it by the kind of abstract nature of the language of pictures and also the more specific language of words. It's a really interesting, involving combination.
It sounds it. And Ellen, this might really be a very good time if you're willing to share some of the book. It's kind of hard because we're not on television. You can't show us photographs of the cartoons. But I know you've got some words to share, and maybe you can describe the cartoons that go with them.
So what I'm going to read from right now is Rock Steady, Brilliant Advice from My Bipolar Life, which is a book that came out this past May. And what it is primarily coping tools for maintaining stability. From my own personal point of view as someone who has bipolar, it's ways to calm down. There's a whole chapter on insomnia. And then it's also ways to remember to take your meds and how to recognize your red flags. So the part that I'm going to read from right now is from the chapter on coping tools. It's about figuring out how to stop emotions that are getting really out of control and kind of spinning out of control. So if you're crying really hard and can't really get out of it or really anxious, so many people are really anxious right now. And I guess I would add one thing that I want to point out about my book, about Rocksteady, is that a lot of this stuff is really not just for people with mood disorders, but also for anybody who experiences moods or emotion, really, pretty much all of us.
Right.
So this part that I'm going to read is about the mammalian diving reflex, which I only learned about when I was researching for Rocksteady. I'll read it to you. If your emotions are in a haywire spiral and you can't calm yourself down, try this fast, effective, and fascinating technique. Plunge into your mammalian diving reflex. And mammalian diving reflex is written on the side of a seal that is diving. A mammal's response to immersion in freezing water is to slow the heart and shut down non-essential body processes. Note that emotional mayhem is a non-essential body process. And I drew a brain and a heart floating underwater, holding their breath. In humans, immersing even just our face and holding our breath causes this response, immediately calming our bodies and minds. It's used in dialectical behavior therapy, and I swear it really works. So just a side note, I just think that this is fascinating how this works for all mammals, including us. Okay, so here's how it goes. One, fill a sink or a big bowl with cold water. And I recommend adding some ice, or I dump in a whole tray. And I drew a picture of dumping a whole tray of ice into a sink. Note, cold water works, but icy cold works better and faster. You have this bowl or sink of icy water. Three, hold your breath and put your face in the water, or at least your forehead and nose and cheek area, for as long as you can. And so I have someone who looks like me, kind of bending over with face in the sink. Four, repeat until you feel calmer. And then it's me holding a towel to my face. Whew. One variation to know about here at the bottom of the page, especially if this happens, like where you want to be ready at work or at school or somewhere that you can't really fill a bowl or sink with cold water. Variation, hold your breath and use an ice cold gel mask. It's not quite as effective, but much more portable. Okay, and then last, a caution. Don't do this if you have heart problems. It really does slow the heart 10 to 30%.
Wow.
I ran into a woman at a reading for Rocksteady, and she had bipolar. She had been diagnosed not long before, and she had been having a problem with crying a lot. And she told me that she found that really, really super useful, and that's in her toolbox, in her repertoire now. And really, that's the whole point of Rocksteady, is to give people tools. It was really satisfying to me that she had folded that into her
right,
own therapy.
Right. I'm sitting here thinking about a lot of times in my life when just instinctively went for cold to calm down and had no idea of why. And so now I do. And the image of the seal and the ice tray, and it's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that part. I know that you must have chosen cartooning as your thing long ago. And I'm wondering how it came to you that you'd be a cartoonist.
Well, I've always drawn and I've always told stories. So it was just something really that, in a way, I've always done. I wasn't going to be a professional artist or cartoonist at all. I went to Wesleyan University and I majored in psychology, actually. A couple of years after graduating and having worked on a psychiatric unit for a bit, I realized that I needed to be an artist. In my early 20s, I decided to be a professional, and I did it.
Yes, you did. And, you know, nothing's ever wasted. I'm sure your background in psychology helps you be interested in researching things about the, what did you call it, the mammalian diving reflex.
It's interesting, actually, to have looped back to psychology. I mean, there's a reason that I majored
right.
in it. I find it fascinating. And so now to be able to combine my interest in psychology and my years of training now, I guess it feels like, in doing comics, that to merge them and integrate them is really, really satisfying. And I love doing research. This is basically the thesis that I never did in school.
That's great. I'm a poet, and it seems like your work does something very similar, boils things down to a very vivid essence and something memorable and moving. And it's a call to action, what the part you read to us and described. It's not just straight medical advice. It's a different kind of call to action. Very human. It has a human face, as you said before, because of the cartoons.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is speaking with book-length cartoonist Ellen Forney about her recent nonfiction graphic books concerning bipolar disorder in her cartooning and teaching career.
So I know that you teach at Cornish in Seattle, and I also know that you've done incredible murals for a new Seattle light rail station in the University District. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if we could talk about that a little bit. First of all, maybe the teaching. What's it like teaching cartooning?
I love it. For me personally, that idea that you learn so much from your students, it sounds like such a cliche, but it's really true.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like for me, it keeps me really excited about comics, and it's always useful to keep breaking it down into its elements and practicing writing and practicing really thinking about design and how the panels work together. It is so satisfying to see the light bulbs go off for the students and to see them playing with these different things in a medium that I feel so passionate about. I always have a few students that are cartoonists, that they've been doing comics for a long time already, and clearly it's what they want to do as a profession. But I really like having students in my class that are music majors or just aren't going to necessarily go into the profession, because there's so many related things, like about design and about writing and sculpting narratives, that wind up being useful for other fields. I love comics. I really, really do.
I can hear that enthusiasm, and I'm making me like them more and more, and I'm going to look at them a little differently. I've been seeing a lot of political cartoons lately and really admiring the messages that can come through from some of the elements that you're talking about. So you mentioned some already. You mentioned the arrows and the panels, the balloons. What other elements are there that you break it down into?
One thing that you just mentioned about political cartoons is really important in comics. For me, one is a sense of humor. Not everyone uses a sense of humor, just like, you know, in any medium. But I find that to get a difficult message across, it really helps connect with the reader and give some perspective. Like, if you can laugh at something, it allows you to take a step back and really look at something. It's disarming. That's why my books are full of humor, perhaps dark humor, if it's really tough. It's also something that I have found one of the greatest coping tools for myself in my life. And then the other thing about, here again, political cartoons that you pointed out is the use of metaphor. It's the use of visual metaphor. Like, for example, in Marbles, one of the probably most reproduced drawings is a description of what the mood states are. And so what is a mood disorder? Because it can get really confusing. There are a couple of different kinds of bipolar and a few different kinds of depression. And then to show what mania and rapid cycling is sort of a really quick back and forth mania and depression, sometimes even within a day, and depression, I drew a carousel. So the horses are going up and down in different ways to show those different mood states. And a lot of people told me that looking at that visual metaphor really allowed them to understand the way that those worked in a way that just descriptions didn't.
Yeah, it's very powerful, because I would never have put a carousel of horses together with cycling between mania and depression. And yet now I have a sense of it. If that were happening, you said even in one day, the horses are not running. They're up and down, and very powerful.
Just a note, creating a visual metaphor like that is some work. When I was originally planning Marbles, I had drawn in my rough sketch a swing, because I thought that would reflect mood swing. But I realized that I needed something that goes up and down. When I was trying to draw the swing, it was going back and forth in an arc, and it just didn't trace the path that I was trying to express. And so I just had to think, okay, what goes up and down in different ways? And that's how I came up with the carousel image.
Yes, and you've described to me in an email how you approached Rock Steady, where you're talking about the fact that when people are having too much cortisol, a flood of it in the brain, it's hard to focus on words. And you said that typeset words on a page become like little crawling ants, and that your aim for your book, Rocksteady, which is a manual of coping tools, is for the reader to be able to use it when they're in the excited state itself. So you chose spare lines, a combination of cues for meaning, you said words and pictures, and an approachable personal angle, and that's really working for people. And as you said before, for people without a diagnosis of bipolar, just people who are experiencing what you called spinning emotions. Can you talk a little bit about the format of Rocksteady and how you helped the reader bypass the crawling ants?
It was something that I found. I've always used spare lines and a certain approachable language that is very embracing of the reader, but a really kind of spare page. I use a brush and India ink, and so my line work is really pretty bold. And a lot of people told me that Marbles was the first book that they had read cover to cover in years. It was anecdotes. It was people telling me that they had dyslexia and they found it so much easier to read Marbles than it had been for any other kind of source of information, text-based in that way.
Right.
So it was something that I wound up looking into because of the reaction that I got to my work. It wasn't that I designed my work that way specifically. Maybe it was a happy accident.
I think it was instinctual. I think that you were onto something. You probably experienced it maybe yourself, trying to focus on words.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's brilliant, and I think it's so helpful to people to have an author be able to reach them through the actual design and format of their presentation. So thank you for the explanation. And I wanted also to ask, where do people go to find graphic? Well, you called it book-length comics, and then within that, there's nonfiction and fiction. Where should we go to find these books? Are they in bookstores mingled in with other books on their topics, or are they in their own sections?
So interesting that you ask that question. It's an issue. I just went to a conference, the American Library Association conference, and it was a topic that was discussed. Where do you shelve these things? Because there are some places that shelve all of the graphic novels or graphica or whatever that one particular library or bookstore has decided to call it. But if they're all shelved together, just like I was saying, there's all these different genres. So like a very serious adult comic, adult themes, might be right next to something that is much more, let's say Calvin and Hobbes or something.
What would your advice be on how to...
Well, the place that I think that a lot of the librarians were saying that they're coming to is to cross shelves. So basically to put it in the place where people will find it according to topic. Mm-hmm. So for example, let's say you...
Okay.
You were looking for a coping tools for bipolar disorder or coping tools for any sort of mental illness or discomfort that way. You would probably go to psychology.
Right.
The psychology section. You wouldn't go to graphica or graphic novels. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an increasing recognition that the way that people are finding these things, especially as people aren't kind of knocked out of the water, if they find a graphic memoir alongside their more established all-text books, they're increasingly being shelved there too.
It also occurs to me that by not intermingling the graphic literature with the topics and text only, it increases the credibility of the book-length comics to have them shelved with other literature, as opposed to all mm-hmm. in their own little place where people can kind of brush it aside if they're not familiar with the genre. And
right.
it seems much happier, both for the genre and for the consumer, to have them available, what you call cross-shelving. So I'm glad to hear that story. And I'm really glad to hear that it's a current topic with librarians and probably booksellers. Let me ask you to be sure to tell us about your project with Seattle's Light Rail.
The Light Rail is an exciting and unfortunately very recent. It's too bad that it hasn't been around for a long time. It runs from just south of the airport up to right now the University District. And the Capitol Hill station opened up in 2016. And I applied for the opportunity to do art in the station. That would have been back before they even dug the hole. So that was back in 2007, the end of 2007, which at that point it seemed like 2016 was, you know, like, aren't we going to have flying cars by then? It just felt so far away. But so I did these big permanent murals. One of them is 40 feet long.
Wow. You can see pictures of these photographs on Ellen's website, which is Ellen Forney, which is Forney.com. And on her website, which you can visit easily, are photographs of these murals in the link tunnel and also links to her books and stories, but also to the Library of Medicine and the traveling exhibit. So now we can continue. I just wanted people to know they'd have the opportunity to see these amazing murals without even going into Seattle. I was very struck, not only with the size, the apparent size of them, but with the subject, what you painted there. It's brilliant, and it's quite different, I think, than you'd expect in a transportation tunnel. So can you tell us what those are and how you came up with that idea?
So there are two murals, and they're both really large. They're in two different entries. One is 28 feet wide, and the other one, as I said, is 40 feet wide. One of them is two hands coming together and crossing pinkies. For a lot of people, that's a pinky swear. And of course, it's pinky swear, but it actually means a whole lot of different things. To me, it actually was something that my friends and I did when we said the same word at the same time when we were kids. And for some people, it's holding hands gently. And that is really a coming together. Since public transportation is about community and coming together and the feeling for the neighborhood that I wanted to emphasize, maybe promote, is that sense. So that first one is called Crossed Pinkies. And the other one is called Walking Fingers. And that is just a playful transportation, really. It's like when you have two fingers and you walk across a table or you walk across your child's belly or whatever, just like a little walking that's about transportation.
When I first saw them, I was so moved because of the pinkies linking, and I got exactly that impression that this was about connection. Mm-hmm. And then talking in terms of metaphor, as you say, you see it, the name of the train is Link. So that was mm-hmm. nice. And then when I saw the fingers walking, I thought, oh, how much fun. When we rush for a train, we're mostly thinking about our legs and our steps. But really, fingers do the walking, as we learned from the telephone books. But it also reminded me that wherever I go, whatever rush I'm in, I'm a whole person. I'm not just a rush. Right. So I really thought they worked beautifully, and it was really lovely to see them. And I hope to see them in person someday.
It's also a way to draw people without really getting gender and culture mm-hmm. and a lot of other like aspects of specific people, and trying to bring that all together and feel inclusive is always a challenge when you're drawing a person, when you're drawing something figurative. Right. And so doing hands was a way that I could bring in a lot of people. As someone with bipolar who is now kind of an advocate and activist about mental health, I'm also part of the disability community. So I'm aware that everyone has different shaped bodies and physical movement. But I think that really my intent was to embrace as many people as I could.
We're coming to a close here in our time, but I want to say what a beautiful ending for our conversation. You've given me so much insight into what goes into cartooning and book-length cartooning and into your process and your teaching. And thank you for this very, very lively discussion. I know that I'm going to be hitting those shelves, probably first the Graphica, so that I can just see a huge body of the work. And then mm-hmm. I'll always look for it when I'm looking at special topics. So thank you so much, Ellen. I wish you all good luck with all that you're doing for the community and for all readers who are interested in your topics and in memoir.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.